And it's really, it's interesting that you asked the question. I just recently read a really good article in Socialist Revolution by Barbara Ehrenreich and Deirdre English on the home economics movement. And they make the
point. Deirdre was on this program, so.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did she talk about
it? Over it. Yeah, you can go over it.
It's a really fine article because it shows how the home economics movement came out of, as I said earlier, an attempt to save the status of the home and give the housewife a sense of herself as a modern person, an efficient manager, you know. And it could have, presumably, if it had been truly radical, moved in the direction of noticing that that was the most efficient thing to do and that it, in fact, would free women to do other things with their lives than the ceaseless drudgery of housework. It didn't. The real ultimate result of the home economics movement was to turn the home into a marketplace. And there's obviously, that is not a marketplace, I'm sorry, a market for the products which are being produced. And it's obviously much more profitable to sell millions of individual refrigerators, you know, than one great big one for a large commune. It is a profitable thing to sell lots of furnishings and lots of even prepackaged goods, you know, to which is Betty Friedan points out in her book, you know, you get the sense that you're a homemaker by adding one egg to this cake flour to make a cake. You still think you're, you know, baking a cake, and it's ridiculous. So it's a profitable thing to have the home be now the consumer. And, of course, it fits into the notion it's no longer a productive enterprise but a consuming enterprise. So it really turned into quite a reactionary thing and, in fact, made the housewife even more menial a worker than she was before. And you still get a sense now of people trying to resurrect the creativity of the home, you know, and through gourmet cooking and interior decorating kind of stuff, you know, and raise the status of it. But it all still works in the direction of consumption.
Reintroducing crafts so that you make things that you could just as easily buy. There's nice parts to that, too, though. It's not, I think. Well,
yes, we're not arguing against craftsmanship. Mm-hmm. It's just that a lot of the things I've seen seem to urge people to buy something in order to make something, mm-hmm. and it still fits very much into the profit-making mode.
Mm-hmm.
And the housewife's position in that is very valuable, which is why I think to this kind of an economic structure, because look at the functions it serves. You know, she can do that at home. Then if the market needs extra labor, it can pull her into, you know, the labor mm-hmm. force and then expel her again. And she never thinks of herself, you know, as a permanent worker. She doesn't even develop the militant mentality very often that would go with hanging in there and fighting for a better wage and, you know, whatever else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which, if you were to socialize some aspects of family life, communalize some mm-hmm. aspects, then women would be truly free to work, and then somebody would have to come up with jobs and a decent wage, I suppose. Okay, so now we've now I want to move ahead to where we had moved before, to the development in later capitalism, where certain aspects of child rearing, such as schooling and schooling, now even down to daycare, right, starting very early, have become socialized.
Mm-hmm.
And we mentioned some of the products which were available that are much greater than even a few years ago for cooking and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Why did this become available? Why did the economic system begin to socialize these aspects of life?
Well, to start with,
if it didn't actually need the women in the labor force,
it needs them as a presence. In other words, as a reserve labor pool, they are needed. For you see this in wartime, women get pulled in fantastically during wartime. They get expelled again then, or we're witnessing right now a reduction in the tide. Women really were moving, you know, into work, and now with the recession, they're being expelled again. So they are useful that way. They keep the wage at a certain place. It's useful. It's not that they're not in the labor force. To talk about socialization of, I mean, what I've called the socialization of the means of reproduction, I think here mainly in terms of reproduction of human beings, you know, raising of children, socialization of children, and or even the sheer sheer physical parts of reproduction, which the medical profession, you know, has such a hold on and maintains such a hold on. To look at that is to think about ways in which it's valuable to keep, in which, what are the ways, all right, this is really interesting, what are the ways in which it's important to socialize your next labor force? Now, one of the things that was important with the beginnings of industrialization was at least minimal skills of, say, literacy, you know, reading and counting, some instructions on machines, you know, or running certain machines, and that already brings in the need for at least a minimal degree of public education. And also education is important to, again, mold people's minds to some degree. It's not a coincidence that nationalism is taught in every public school. It sets up a state of mind, you know, which is valuable altogether for maintaining that particular system. So education comes in any case. And the reason for higher and higher levels of education is also a very complicated question, because obviously you don't need a very high degree of education to do all sorts of skills. That partly is ways of finding the labor force that will move into higher parts of the hierarchy and become managers. And, you know, as work becomes increasingly differentiated, you find more and more differentiated layers of supervisory managerial positions, which sometimes really conceal that it's at working class. As I said before, people mm-hmm. don't feel it. That's one aspect of it. But another aspect is, I think people became really aware of this, again, in the big depression of 29, that when high school became mandatory in the United States, it's a way of keeping children off the labor market. You know, a lot of the impulse against child labor is not only humanitarian, but really economic. I've been very startled to see how crude that is sometimes in the materials that I've been looking at in my studies of German women in the 1920s, where they very specifically say that, you know, child labor is competitive. I mean, sure, they care about the kids, but they know it's depressing even their own unskilled wages. So it's a way of keeping people off the labor market for a long time. And when there was this big expansion in college education, some of that really was to keep kids off the labor market, you know, for yet another 4 years. And so partly it works in that direction. Education works in that direction. I think public health is like really another interesting area that
or welfare, maybe.
Or welfare, yeah, which are all like ameliorative services, which prevent the kind of restiveness that might lead to a more revolutionary approach. In other words, as long as people can find some kind of help out of, you know, perfectly awful misery, these are things that progressive parties have fought for, even socialist parties have fought for, you know, and they are a way of preventing further unrest. So to the degree that they're ameliorative services. In fact, they came out of ameliorative services. That's another interesting thing. A lot of these women we talked about from the middle class in the 19th century who were unhappy about their passive role created for themselves a kind of work, and that was charitable work. And whatever they might have thought their motives were, however humane they probably really may have felt in many instances, they were also doing two things with that. First of all, they were getting themselves out of boredom. Secondly, they were fulfilling the function of their class, in a sense, by bringing the new laboring class into a way of thinking closer to their own. For example, to keep a tidy house, not have a sloppy house. That sort of socializing
Jean Adams
people.
And Hull House and things
right.
like that you're thinking of.
Right. Shaping.
Went to work with immigrants and then.
Right. Yeah. Americanization. Another, mm-hmm. for the United States, a very important part, getting people to be more American, to have a neat, clean house, preferably nuclear family oriented and away from the sloppy big families that kept crashing in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's there it started as partly an ameliorative and function, which was also a way of bringing people into a uniform mode of thinking that in effect would continue to support the system. And that then becomes more public, taken over by the state as a more reliable and better distributed form of ameliorative policy.
Mm-hmm. Now, women work widely in these fields.
Right.
Right. That's mm-hmm. where women can find jobs,
right.
White-collar jobs. But they're not in the higher echelons of these fields, generally speaking. Mm-hmm. That's so.
Mm-hmm. That's so. And the more entrenched they become, the less do you find women have very often created these structures, and then when they become taken over by the state or dropped out. For example, when I went to high school, a lot of the principals were women. And that's not true anymore, you know. It also is partly a function of it's partly a function of higher levels of pay, which then attracts more men into certain kinds of jobs and then disemploys women in those jobs. It's really a function of a lot of things. Hierarchical organizational structures are hard for women to operate in for a lot of reasons, one of the major ones being that they really don't control major property that would allow them to get into such a structure. And secondly, they not in large numbers because of their familial duty, which interrupts, for example, female legislators. Don't get terribly far. Usually the end of a female legislator's life would be the state legislature. That is what she reaches after she's gone through smaller levels of education boards, you know, school boards or municipal and then state. For men, state legislatures are just a takeoff, you know, mm-hmm. into higher things. Mm-hmm. And if a woman has had any kind of a family life, that is almost invariably interrupted it, you know.
Mm-hmm. So from what I can make of what we've been saying, it seems like the woman's role has been sapped of just every bit of creativity, power, significance, essentialness in the society. And that where she now participates, whether it's as a mother to her own children, she is dictated to, her standards, her actions are dictated by public health officials, psychologists, child guidance counselors, teachers, okay. Then when she moves into those fields, just those very fields which look very much like her mothering role, mm-hmm. she does it at the lower echelon mm-hmm. and in fact has above her not only a man, a husband, but a kind of anonymous and very powerful authority mm-hmm. in the state ultimately, right? What is the significance of this? I mean, what, again, we're asking the question about whether it's to be looked at as a liberating development or not, or what ways it is liberating and what ways it isn't. And let me add something else, because what mm-hmm. we've started to talk about women now moving into the work world and the ways that they have moved in mm-hmm. and how that, in a way, has undermined altogether their home role. Their home, that still exists. Most people still mm-hmm. live in families. Mm-hmm. And there probably is more equality in those families now for women, right? Mm-hmm. You probably can get your husband to go shopping on Friday night with you and to wash the dishes, mm-hmm. no, to babysit. Mm-hmm. However, that's it, you know? I mean, there's not much power there. There's not much significance even over mm-hmm. your own children, right? So how do we measure this in those terms of liberation, non-liberation? And then we'll get on to social change.
that's a biggie.
Well, it seems to me that that is very significant, you know. We can talk about that in other ways. We can talk about the media and the whole of people's private behavior being mm-hmm. dictated. Yeah. So that the question is whether we're moving toward a kind of robotized mm-hmm. state of existence, or whether you see potentialities for greater freedom there.
Before I tackle the big one, let me just take a second out about the companionate marriage mm-hmm. idea, because it really is a very interesting phenomenon, I think. And I think it partly is an indication of the way in which men, you know, the average man, the majority, men's own role has also declined, because, I mean, you know, in these hierarchical structures, we're talking about monopolization of capital at a very peak level, you know, and there are not very many men who are independent either. We're all subject, you know, to that state authority. So part of the egalitarianism, I think, where it does exist, is a creeping recognition of that, you know, that affects people in two ways. Sometimes it affects people with a refusal of recognition, like, for example, I think the very embattled working man, you know, the really mm-hmm. Manual laborer who to face that would be like to lose his last shred of sense of self, you know, and might therefore be even more misogynistic, even more oppressive. You know, it's possible. But another phase of that would be to recognize, you know, the shared oppression and to come together on a more egalitarian basis. So in that sense, it could be very hopeful, you know. In other words, if it really depends, you know, on the level of consciousness of people. It's a very difficult point, again, to look at the very contemporary situation. We can look around us and we can see people battling for very scarce jobs, vicious situation. And nobody can honestly blame anybody else for wanting a job and saying they don't want this person and that person. And yet it obviously flies in the face of, say, affirmative action.
Right. So sure. Every other day on the op-ed page of the Times is an article about why we shouldn't have affirmative. Maybe we should have affirmative action hiring. Maybe we shouldn't. And that's getting played out.
Sure. It's getting played out. And I really think a big backlash in women and minorities who had made really not even very large gains, just a few minor ones. In fact, they were looking... Those of us who were looking at it, they were starting to look like the revolving door, like, sure, let them in, and, we'll cool them out again. Even that door seems not terribly available.
It's locked.
It's locked, right. And there's a lot of internecine fighting, between races and between sexes. And
how do you see this economic retrenchment? Do you see do you see it as a deliberate attack on the movement that Black people were making and women were making for advances in the society, for changes in the society? Do you see it as a manipulated crisis, or do you see it there was a real economic crisis and the way the people who are going to get it is the last hired?
That's a very heavy professional economics question, and I've heard people who are much more conversant in economics than I am debate it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm inclined to think, from what I've heard, that there is a very serious crisis of capitalism going on, but the sections we see are very often manipulated crisis. The crisis of the city, I think, is a manipulated crisis, and yet behind that there is another crisis. In other words, it is used to make changes, say, in education, in the structure of the working class, and the story, what we hear is, gee, there's no money. Well, how can you fight there's no money, and in fact, it's, the kind of crisis level it's happening on, and, finance, capital, and multinational corporations is not the side we get to see very much of, or have much input into. So what I think happens, at least what I see really happen, is that a crisis can be used to cool out people who are undesirable. That isn't always necessarily every ethnic group or every women's group. In fact, the tensions and the necessity of a job, people can be used to be pitted one against the other. Again, that will prevent them, that can prevent them from uniting, and it can also reduce wages again, because there is such competition. So to answer your question, really, I don't even think I really can, because it depends on a very clear knowledge of what people's sense of their own oppression is and how best to combat it. I think that people have a pretty, people I get to talk to have a pretty strong awareness that it's really regrettable that they are fighting each other, that each other is not necessarily the enemy, but that in the day-to-day struggle for existence, they will do the best for themselves that they can. The question you raised about, I don't know whether you meant this, like an alienated consciousness in a sense of having been, say, to come back to women, having been brought to a level of recognizing that you're really usually in the low-skilled jobs, in the lesser-paid jobs, that a few token women may rise, and that's always held out as bait for us, but that once you really get to see that tends to be the overall thing, how to react to that, how to overcome demoralization is probably a question of, what the conjuncture of circumstances is, what organizations there are to fight back, what how you can do both, sort of like continue to live in this world with them in makeshift ways at the same time as preparing, for, let's say, a more desirable future where you could have communal living arrangements. And some people do, have communal living arrangements, like my nice cab driver who brought me here. And hi. who is living in just such a situation and finds it, in spite of its grueling poverty and strenuousness, very rewarding and prefers to live that way, than to accrue whatever material awards you might gain by having a more privatized existence, say, in the city. Mm-hmm. So I think it, really depends on where you're at. But people, I still hear a lot of talk, more and more talk about, mm-hmm. Wanting to get away from an alienated
existence.
Well,
it's just that when I look now at the job picture is one picture, and then there was a story in the newspaper the other day about daycare being cut back again, and daycare has
right.
been cut more than any other service.
Right.
And so I guess if you're not going to hire women, you don't have to hold out daycare for them.
Yes.
And it's, okay, so those areas are being severely affected. And I don't see a real outpouring of protest against it. I think probably the daycare mm-hmm. people are protesting. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, they seem to be more isolated than they were when they were putting together their daycare centers a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And they would stop cars in the streets. And you would sort of know about them more, you know, that they
yeah.
were trying to get control of their daycare centers and get money.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like, you know, just a very devastating thing is happening.
Daycare is a very good place to where you can really see what a manipulated crisis is. In World War II, where daycare centers were really needed for women working, you know, in defense, there was a very conscious correspondence between state and federal agencies, very conscious of the fact that they thought daycare was undesirable because it would lead people to think that there were other modes than the private family, that they might start thinking like socialistically. And even in that situation of dire need for daycare, they deliberately held back funds from the creation of daycare in order to prevent the dissolution, what they considered would be the dissolution of the family, the mainstay of all these ideological props, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes a lot of sense, therefore, that, you know, these services are being cut back today.
It was giving people a vision of a
sure.
different possibility. Yeah.
Sure.
But let's look at that for a minute because we only have another couple of minutes.
Right.
Is when you look at the women's movement from the vantage point that you look at it, what are the most interesting indications that you see? It seems to me that we left out a whole area here of changing of sexuality. You know, we haven't talked much about that.
Mm-hmm.
But perhaps with that in mind, the word sexuality,
mm-hmm.
you can just look around and tell me what were the most interesting developments that you saw beyond women pressing for a larger and more significant participation in the work sphere.
Mm-hmm. Well, sexuality is an area of privacy, you know, private autonomy, where people still like to think they have some, you know, they have some choices and some freedom of choice. And it was a very important component of all consciousness-raising groups. I was also in a consciousness-raising group. And sexuality, in its broadest sense, in specifically intercourse, in questions of heterosexual, homosexual relationships, and then in its broader sense of sexual relations, that is to say power relations or interpersonal relations, you know, between the sexes. And there was a lot of very sensitive exploration of how people felt about that. And, of course, out of that, a lot of action came. I mean, consciousness-raising groups often moved into action because when they started exploring their personality, they found different places, you know, for it to go. That's probably been among the most successful areas, I would say, that the women's movement has moved into. Although I wish it were even more successful, you know. I mean, it's partly still, I'm afraid, a class phenomenon. You know, I mean, it's really disheartening to see how many poorer women are not either aware of contraception or sometimes just don't have the accessibility, still are driven to the need for abortion and don't have that accessibility, you know, that
They won't if the presidential candidates have their way.
Right.
And the abortion thing
right.
is really very
it's
surprisingly
incredible.
Under attack, isn't it?
It's incredible that in 1976 that should still be so, you know,
mm-hmm.
so that what is an area of liberation to people like you and me, I think, you know, because we do know how to take care of ourselves, and that's really nice, you know, that can be a free area and move, at least on an interpersonal relationship, one can move into some more independence. But for people that don't have that accessibility, it still becomes then a trap, and you almost begin to understand, although I, you know, argue it all the time with my students in my classes, I argue against, you know, the family centeredness or the chastity orientation, which is the double standard in effect, but you can almost still see why it would operate on levels like that, where it's, you know, the only protection of the woman still from oppression is to say no, which is not you know, it would not perhaps be her free choice as far as her sexual life is concerned. So I think there has been a lot of important movement, you know, and I think those are areas where we could probably, even within this structure, probably make strides, because it's, I think it could be, you know, it just, I don't really, I'm sorry if it's coming across paranoid. I don't mean it to sound paranoid, but I think there is a lot of room there, even for manipulation, that it could be like those ameliorative services, you know, like the entertainment industry is something that we get for our leisure, that free sexuality is something that may be permissible, you know, like smoking pot may be permissible, you know, because it's a steam valve. And I wouldn't want to run it down. I think, you know, it as a as an area of personal freedom, it's desirable. But in itself, it's probably not sufficient, you know, and it's just got to be, I think, on all fronts, like continuous movement and consciousness raising, like sort of in all these areas of what constitutes autonomy.
Yeah.
A lot of work to do.
Yeah, it sure is. Yeah. The question is whether it can be done or whether we should take
Well, there's
on
no alternative. You
right.
Know? I mean, it's got to be done. The alternative is worse.
And these ideas are very interesting to stay with. Anyway, our time is up, really.
Okay.
So there were a couple of announcements I wanted to make. And my guest was Renata Breidenthal, who, as I said earlier, is a historian, teaches at Brooklyn College, and is a coordinator of the Women's Studies program there. So you know now that Brooklyn College has a Women's Studies program for the time being, anyway. And I have been offering to people who send me a stamped self-addressed envelope a list of the publications by the various people who've been on the program, because if I started reading it off to you, it gets too complicated, and they're in various places. So I would suggest that if you're interested in seeing something that Renata has written, that you write to me for this list. Now, when you get the list, that's, again, a problem, because they're in journals, and they're all over the place, and they cost a lot of money. And if you want to select for yourself some materials, if you're interested in these ideas and in the women's movement generally, there's a very nice bookstore called Woman Books on West 92nd Street between Broadway and West End Avenue. That's West 92nd Street between Broadway and West End Avenue. And you go in there, and it's quite delightful. They usually have coffee. There's a place for kids if you bring kids, so you can look around and not have to mind the children. And you can sit down in a chair and read a journal and decide if you really want it or if you want another one you didn't get a chance to read. So if you want to look at some materials, go to Woman Books on West 92nd Street off Broadway. And another announcement which I was asked to make concerns a women artists exhibition which is going to take place at Avery Fisher Hall at Lincoln Center on February 15th through the 28th. That's of this month, the 15th through the 28th. And there will be very well-known women artists exhibited there, Alice Neal and Dorothy Gillespie and others. I won't read the whole list. And you can go to this place, Lincoln Center, Avery Fisher Hall, Monday through Saturdays, 1 in the afternoon to 9 in the evening. So those are two other nice contacts to make with these ideas. Next time, Feminist Conversation is going to have a discussion of poetry. I decided to try aesthetics for a time. And so that'll be in 2 weeks on Sunday evening at 10 p.m. I'm Nanette Raynone, and good night.